It was a couple of weeks ago, or maybe even a couple of months ago, I don't recall exactly. We were planning worship services, and I gazed into my crystal ball, and I saw that this white supremacy issue and driving into a crowd issue in Charlottesville, Virginia was going to happen, and that's why we decided to call our message today Pride and Prejudice. That's about as tongue-in-cheek an intro as I can give you. We don't plan these things, do we? They just seem to happen. And if you're here often enough, then you've kind of seen coincidentally that they happen more often than not. And so I take comfort in knowing that the Lord goes before even us on staff as we're planning worship services weeks and months in advance, giving us an opportunity not only to speak from His Word, but an opportunity to hopefully take His Word out as a community of faith into the places where we live and have something to offer people that are angry, that are hurting, that are hopeless, that feel like our country's falling apart. Man, the church is still here. The people of God are still here, and we still have a message of hope to offer and a message of peace to offer. We still do. That hasn't changed. But we do have to be willing to get up and go out from here and tell people. We have to be willing to get up and go and tell. Which brings us to the prophet Jonah today. The prophet Jonah. Our third story in a summer of short stories. Ruth was an opportunity for us to consider serving within our own church family, our own community. Nehemiah, an opportunity for us to consider what being a transformational agent in our own city looks like. And of course, all of you that have been a part of a New Testament church have heard about or perhaps even participated in the church's global mission, our recognition that that God is sending us anywhere that we have the capacity to go. And in today's world, that is everywhere. It's everywhere. And to proclaim the good news. And so for us here, it means that the book of Jonah reminds us we're not only to be difference makers in our own family and our own church, we're not only to be difference makers in our own city, but we're to be difference makers anywhere around the world, elsewhere in our own country, other countries, anywhere that the Lord creates a window of opportunity for us. An open door is a chance for us to go and hopefully engage with other brothers and sisters in Christ, or if it's to go somewhere where there are none, to go and be the first presence or the only presence of God, the only presence of Jesus in those places. And so Jonah is the furthest concentric circle as we think about serving, as we think about being transformational agents. You hear the stories often about who we partner with: Dominican Republic, we partner South Africa, we partner Southeast Asia, we partner, South Texas Children's Home here in our state, we partner with churches around our country. And our hope and goal is not only to be difference makers and agents of transformation here in Houston, but to contribute to transformation as it's taking place in communities around the world. Jonah may not be the most positive example of that, but he may be the most successful example of that. As we consider his book over the next 4 weeks, there was not a more reluctant prophet than him, but I think he had a 100% success rate. And so his story will be an interesting one for us. It's one of the more peculiar books in all of the Old Testament. The book of Jonah fits within the 12 minor prophets. In fact, if you think about the corpus of the prophetic writings in the Old Testament, it's three major prophets that are three of the four largest books in the Bible: Jeremiah number 1, Psalms number 2, Isaiah number 3, Ezekiel number 4. Three of the four largest books in the Bible, and many scholars think that the 12 minor prophets were compiled together to be a fourth, a unity. 12 different writings, 12 different authors, kind of cobbled together to be a fourth scroll to go along with the other three. Jonah sits in the middle, and if you need to find it in your Bible, he comes right after Obadiah, which is one page. Right after Obadiah, right before Micah, which is a little bit longer. But it may take you between now and the end of my introduction to find it, so please go ahead and start now. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah is the first six. Jonah is the only one of those 12 for whom the book is a story, not sermons. Old Testament scholars will refer to these preachings, these messages that the prophets delivered as oracles, which makes me think of the Never-Ending Story when I was a kid. But they refer to them as oracles. All of the other minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, they're all sermons or messages delivered. Jonah is the only one that tells a story. It's a prophetic narrative instead of a prophetic message, which makes him unique. If you're looking for something to compare Jonah to, in fact, next week I'll give you a little list of parallels. The closest literature in the Old Testament we have to Jonah is actually the stories of Elijah and Elisha, located in the books of Kings, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, prophetic narratives. We know a whole lot more about Elijah and Elisha. We know a whole lot more about Jonah than we do about Haggai. We don't know anything about Haggai. We don't know anything about Obadiah, because we don't have any stories about them. And in Jonah's case, we do. So it's a unique writing in that sense. I'll give you some facts about Jonah here in a minute. But we did tag the sermon this morning. We've titled it according to Jane Austen's novel, Pride and Prejudice. Not because of what's going on in our country today, but in large part because that's Jonah in my mind. When I think about Jonah, I think of Pride and Prejudice. And that explains a lot of his responses and reactions to God's call on his life. I'll be honest, I've read like a Cliff's Notes version of Pride and Prejudice. I've not read it. But Jane Austen, who was an English writer, wrote in the early 1800s this story of a family that had five good British, you know, daughters, all unmarried. And it's a story about the class and manners and etiquette and culture and boundaries, and how the daughters have to maintain a certain set of etiquette and manners in order to attract a certain caliber and class of men that kind of move in and out of their little manor in this rural countryside of England. I never read Pride and Prejudice, but I feel like I watched it on TV, only it was called Downton Abbey, if any of you guys watched it. It's exactly the same premise. But the title, really, it's a love story. People that, you know, that love, you know, the old literary love stories, it's a love story, but in the sense that, kind of like Romeo and Juliet is, that love and happiness really has the power to overcome whatever kinds of social boundaries and prejudices exist. In our day and age, sometimes racial prejudices get the most amount of attention. In Jane Austen's novel, it was more about social class. Everybody was the same race, but depending on what family, your family line was, or what class you were in, and we realize that prejudices can be based on religion, they can be based on nationalism, they can be based on race, they can be based on socioeconomic status. But we do believe that the calling of God, that the New Testament church is God's plan to create one people comprised of every tribe, every tongue, every nation around the world. And so as the New Testament church, we should always be challenging any form of prejudice, whatever face it takes, wherever it happens to be that we live. It's really not enough for us to just say, well, I don't feel that way. Lots of stuff with my colleagues, pastor friends, ministry friends, about how we need to get up and talk about this on Sunday. And I thought, you know, I know a lot of most everybody in my church. I don't know that I have any people that are terribly racist here. I don't know that we have any white supremacists. I don't know that we have any, you know, any people that feel this way. The challenge for us, I don't need to tell you not to be racist, not to be prejudiced. What we need to do is, as a community of believers, figure out how we respond to this in our country. How we respond as a community of faith. What do we say? How do we act? That's a much harder question. That's something that I personally continue to wrestle with. And Jonah is, look, Jonah was a Hebrew prophet. And one of the other oddities about him is he was sent to Gentiles to proclaim the message of God. Amos was not, Hosea was not, Isaiah was not, Ezekiel was not, Jeremiah was not. Elijah and Elisha were. Those are about the only other examples. But Jonah was sent not to the people of God, not to the Hebrews, but to go and proclaim God's message to outsiders. In fact, outsiders that he very likely hated. They were Assyrians. They were the enemy. What an appropriate time to talk about Jonah. It is so, so, so much more than just a story of a guy that got swallowed by a big fish. So much more. And that may be the only thing that stuck from flannel board storytelling when you were in church as a kid, was the guy got swallowed by a fish. But it is a story of prejudice. It's a story of evangelism. It's a story of the power of God to change people's lives. It's a story of the discrepancy between self-righteous worshipers of God and humble, fearful people that don't know God yet but have such close capacity and potential. The discrepancy between the two, and sometimes the transposition of those and how they stand before God. It's such an incredible writing. And so I hope you'll come as often as you can over the next 4 weeks. We're going to spend this week and three more wrapping up our summer series with the book of Jonah. So Pride and Prejudice, Jonah chapter 1. I'm going to begin reading. Let me talk about Bible translations for you. We often use the New International Version in here. The Bible I preach from is the NIV, but it is the 1984 version. If you ever notice differences in what I'm reading and what's on the screen or what's on your device, it's because, digitally speaking, the NIV 1984 has been updated to the NIV 2011, and you can't get the 84 anymore on your digital device. It's unheard of that we've just eradicated a whole translation of the Bible. And so, normally I do that. Today I'm going to be reading from the New American Standard. The slides on the screen are going to be from the New International Version 1984, because we do have that in-house. If you're on a device, you're going to be on the New International Version 2011. And if you have your own different translation, then just feel free to read whatever it is that you have. Here's the reason why, though, I bring this up, is because Jonah is art. It is highly, highly stylized. Every word, every phrase is structured in such a way so that it comes across poetically, beautifully. It's really, really incredible. And there are, I've not found an English translation that does a fair job bringing that across. And so we're going to do our best kind of looking at some different examples, and there are things I want to point out in the New American Standard that the NIV misses. So pardon the discrepancies in what I'm reading and what you see on the screen, but hopefully you can kind of follow along. So the book of Jonah, chapter 1. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai, saying, and here's the first thing I don't like about the NIV, is there are two verbs at the beginning of verse 2. He says, arise, go. Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and call against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. Or literally it says, come up before my presence. But Jonah arose and fled to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa, found a ship which was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. A couple of things that are taking place here. This word arise and go and call, these are the commands of God, and they keep coming up over and over again throughout the rest of the book. They're kind of important, so whenever the NIV leaves one out, I'm not okay with that. Part of the stylism here, God says arise and go, and so Jonah arises and flees. We don't get this very much in the prophets. Mostly what happens when God gives a command or a call to a prophet, the prophet does what? What is it? He argues. Yeah, more often than not, they argue, but then ultimately do what? Relent. They ultimately go and do whatever God says. God tells Isaiah. Isaiah comes up with excuses. I'm a man of unclean lips. He tells Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, I'm just a youth. I'm not very old. He tells Ezekiel. Ezekiel says, well, I'm kind of crazy. He tells Moses, and Moses comes up with a litany of excuses why he shouldn't go and do what God does. But in all four of those cases, they all relent and obey. We should get used to seeing when the prophetic call comes, the prophet arguing, so much so that when Noah, when God gives him this ludicrous command to go build a boat in the middle of nowhere, and Noah gets up and just goes and does it, that should stand out to us. So should this. Whenever Jonah doesn't even put up a fight, he just gets up. It's almost like halfway through the command, we think, okay, he's going to obey. And then he does one of these. He does this and takes off. It's important. These words are going to come up again later. It's also important, I think, that God tells him, he says, look, the sins of the Ninevites have come up before my presence, and that's why I want you to do this. And twice it emphasizes that Jonah then wanted to flee from the presence of God, as though he could. Where's he going to go? Well, Nineveh's this way. It's the capital of the Assyrian Empire. So I'm going to go to Tarshish, which is across the ocean, about as far away from Nineveh as I can go. And maybe I can hide from God there. He goes down to Joppa, and then he goes down to the ship. And then once he gets to the ship, he goes down into her. Ships were feminine, if you know masculine, feminine language. And Hebrew says he goes down into her. He's trying to hide. He's trying to get away from God because he wants to have nothing to do with this request. Nothing to do with it. Some notes about Jonah before I give you my first point. We know from 2 Kings chapter 14 that Jonah was a historical figure. He was a prophet in the courts of King Jeroboam II. Jeroboam was not a good king. He was a king in the north over the 10 northern tribes. His years of reign are estimated circa 793 to 753. If you're thinking contextually, the northern kingdom would fall to Assyria in 722. We're working backwards because these are BC dates or BCE dates. Jeroboam II, one of the longer tenured kings, 40 years, right before the destruction of the northern kingdom. And 2 Kings tells us that Jonah was a prophet speaking to the kings of the north. This would have made him a contemporary of Amos, most likely. Hosea, most likely. The actual writing of the book of Jonah, however, is undated. We don't know exactly when it was written. If it was written shortly after the events that it tells, or if it was told in oral tradition and passed down through generations and written down maybe centuries later, we're not entirely sure. One thing we do know is the book of Jonah uses a lot of Aramaic words that we don't see elsewhere in much of the Old Testament. If you saw Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, the actors, and Jesus in particular, that movie was told in what language? It was in Aramaic, if you didn't know that, and you had to read it in English subtitles. Aramaic is cognate with Hebrew, same alphabet, but just like English and Spanish, or maybe better, Spanish and Italian, are similar, they're not the same languages. And so the fact that there's a lot of Aramaic words used in this, the word for ship being one of them here early on, has led some scholars to suggest that this was written closer to the intertestamental period, maybe after the exile of Jerusalem. 5th century, that would put it a couple hundred, 200 or 300 years removed from the events. Maybe this is the case, maybe not. That's not proof or evidence, it's just an observation. But one thing it does, if you go to the next slide, what some scholars would say is that if Jonah was written after the exile, around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, which we just finished looking at, around a time whenever the Israelites were really insulating themselves from all of the other nations around them, really cutting off ties with Samaritans, with Canaanites, with Phoenicians, with everybody else, all of a sudden this book seems to be a contrast to Ezra and Nehemiah, who would tell the Israelites to divorce their pagan wives and send them away, all of a sudden Jonah comes in and it's going to portray these pagans as more righteous than the prophet of the Hebrew people. Here's a quote that I thought was compelling. The later writing theory proposes that the purpose of the book was to oppose the overzealous nationalism and ethnocentrism during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. In other words, that it was an anti-racism, anti-prejudice book. That the Israelites had become prejudiced based on their own faith. We are the people of God. Clearly, those Ninevites are not. We are the people of God. That it was written to oppose that kind of thinking. Here's my contention, regardless of when the book was written. Israelites then and the people of God throughout our history as Christians have always wrestled with an air of superiority. Have we not? With the looking down at others, looking down our nose at others, itis. We've always had that tendency. And so I don't think that the themes of prejudice or God extending his message and his love to all people really needs to be time determined. I don't think it matters if it was in the 5th century or if it was in the 8th century or if it was in our century. I don't think it matters. I think the theology and the point there carries either way. So we do know that Jonah was a historical figure. We do know that that he served in the courts, that he was a prophet. In fact, some of his reluctance to go, we'll look at this when we get to chapter 4. Some of his reluctance to go might have been all of these things. If he made his money by proclaiming what God was going to do, then it would really put him in a precarious place to go proclaim God was going to do something, and then God didn't do it. I.e., God is going to wipe you out, and then the Ninevites repent, and God doesn't. So many elements at play here. As we come into the book of Jonah, we see this. Jonah's call, his mandate, the prophetic mission was this: arise, go, and call. In other words, call to repent. And so, first point this morning, there we go. Jonah begins with the commands to arise, go, and call. As a professional prophet, Jonah had already been delivering God's messages. That passage in 2 Kings talks about him prophesying an expansion of the boundaries of the northern kingdom or of the land of Israel. And he told about this, and then it happened. The kings led in that expansion of their territory. He'd been delivering God's message as a career for who knows how long. But here, something was different. He was being sent outside the domain of God's people to the outsiders. And yet, God had a message for them as well. God had a message for the Assyrians. God had a message for the Babylonians. God had a message for the Egyptians. God has a message for all the people that we interact with that do not know him yet. It would be a lot to look at Jonah and say, yeah, God's mandate to Jonah is the same as God's mandate to us. But if you've read the New Testament much at all, you should know that God's command to Jonah is the command to us to arise and go and tell, to make known his salvation, his message, his gospel anywhere, that we are to be an evangelical people. Sharing the good news, sharing the gospel with people that do not know him yet. And in light of these recent events, not only this week, but just so much tension and fighting around the country, around our world, I have to put myself in Jonah's position and say, you know, God didn't send Jonah to Egypt. Because in the lifetime of Jonah, Egypt wasn't their primary enemy. God didn't send Jonah to Babylon, even though 150 years after him, Babylon would be the world's number one villain. He sent Jonah to the people that Jonah had every reason to hate. He sent Jonah to the capital city of the nation that within 30 years of the end of Jeroboam's reign would march on their city and destroy them and carry their people off into exile. That's who God sent Jonah to. And so I have to take this sentiment, not just the fact that God is sending me to arise and go and tell coworkers and neighbors, people that we interact with that are good people, that are nice people, people that we like, they just don't have any spiritual concern. They don't know God. But that in light of events yesterday, not yesterday, the past few days, even white supremacists protesting and marching, and those people are image bearers of God. Garrett mentioned it in his prayer earlier. Those people are image bearers of God. I wanted to read a quote to you. A friend, a ministry friend in the city of Houston named Jim Harrington, was writing and just kind of talking about how he... Did I lose it? Oh, crud. I had it queued up and now it disappeared. Oh, there he is. Jim. Temporary pause. Where are we at? In his answer, he quoted the Dutch Jewish writer Etty Hillesum, a Dutch Jewish woman who was known for courageously fighting to rescue people from Auschwitz, and herself in the process ultimately was captured and put to death in the gas chambers. There's a woman that died at the hands of Nazi white supremacists. And she wrote about her captors. Like us, they too are bearers of the divine image, however deeply marred and buried it may be. And so they are people to whom we belong. To remove from the mind the label of enemy is like removing the blinds from a window and letting the light in. If you will not hate them, then you may begin to see them. We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds. Those aren't even my words, but that's a mic drop moment. Like us, they too are bearers of the divine image, however deeply marred and buried it may be. And so they are people to whom we belong. To remove from the mind the label of enemy is like removing the blinds from a window and letting the light in. If you will not hate them, then you may begin to see them. We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds. Jonah is an example for us in all of the negative reasons. But in all of his negative examples, sometimes I see myself in him and it makes me uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable. So, what do we do? Let's keep reading. Arise, go, and call. I think the first thing we do is recognize that the commands God gave to Jonah, while that's a bit of a stretch in connecting it to us, the New Testament mandate that we go into all nations, making disciples of all people and baptizing them, the Great Commission, is a command to all disciples of Jesus to arise and go and call. And so all of a sudden, if we wouldn't put ourselves in Jonah's shoes before, maybe we should consider doing so. Verse 4, Jonah's in the bottom of a ship, and the Lord hurled a great wind on the sea, and there was a great storm on the sea, so that the ship was about to break up. Then the sailors were introduced to these guys. They became afraid, they feared, and every man cried to his God, and they threw the cargo which was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. The sailors occupy three verbs. They fear, and they cry out, or they call out. They do exactly what Jonah was commanded to do. They call out, and then they throw overboard. These are pagans. They don't know whose God is who. They don't care. They each have their own gods. And as they're on the ship and they're about to wreck, each one of them are out there praying to however many different gods are represented by the crew. All gods that aren't even gods. And yet they exemplify more faith in their non-gods than Jonah does. But Jonah had gone below into the hold of the ship, had laid down and had fallen asleep. The pagans who don't believe in God were struggling and wrestling and praying and crying out and throwing stuff overboard. In the midst of a storm, they were laboring and working and striving and trying to make a difference. And the prophet of God had gone down below, had laid down, and fallen asleep. Oh, let that not ever be metaphorical for us, too. Let that not ever be a figurative picture of us. So the captain approached him and said, "How are you sleeping? Get up." You know what word that is in Hebrew? Arise. Why we translate it differently in two different places, I don't know. Same word. The captain tells Jonah exactly what God told Jonah to do. Arise and call on your God. Come help us, join us. Maybe your God can fix this where ours cannot. Perhaps your God will be concerned about us so that we will not all perish. You know, when the command to arise and call, Jonah had already made up his mind that he was not going to do that. He wasn't going to do that when God told him to. And so here when the captain comes, he's not going to do it then either. Each man... The sailors said to each other, the NAS says, each man said to his mate, that's good sailor language, come and let us cast lots so that we may learn on whose account this calamity has struck us. So they cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. And then they said to him, tell us now on whose account has this calamity struck us? And look how, I mean, The literature is written so as to be frantic. Tell us who's responsible. What do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you? Hurry, give us the answers or we're going to die. It communicates the speed of frenzied panic. All right, and starting in verse 9, I'm going to read the Hebrew translations where we get the Lord in place of the name of God. I'm going to read the name of God because I think it's important. The contrast is strong. So Jonah says, I am a Hebrew and I fear Yahweh. I worship Yahweh, the God of heaven who made the sea and the land. I am a Hebrew and this is who I worship. And then the men became extremely frightened, and they said to them, how could you do this? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of Yahweh because he had told them. Let's stop right there for a minute. Jonah proudly stands up after the lot had fallen on him and says, I am a Hebrew and I worship the God of the Hebrew people. Yahweh is his name. And yet previously, he had already told the soldiers that he was fleeing from the presence of Yahweh, that his God had told him to go do something and he didn't want to do it and he was running away. And yet he was very happy to self-profess himself as a worshiper of the Lord. Do you guys see something funny with that, those two verses back to back? You should. If not, read it again. Second point. Jonah was quick to voice his belief in God, quick to announce himself as a worshiper of God, all the while rebelling, disobeying, fleeing from the God in whom he claimed to believe, the God whom he professed to worship. Such a hypocritical picture. And this is the prophet. This is the one representing the people of God. If Jonah refused to take God's message to those whom he was being sent, then does he truly qualify as a servant of the Lord? He claims to worship the Lord while at the same time completely disobeying him. We're going to be moving into the fall. Some of you that were at leadership training over the past weekend, moving into the fall, we're entering into a season of kind of recrafting some vision language for us as a church. What is our vision? We're not looking to change our identity, but we're looking to solidify our identity here and then craft a vision for us as we start looking ahead, 2020, 2025, the years down the road. What does that look like for us? And so all kinds of questions are coming up. Who do we want to be? Who do we need to try and shift and change into? There are some things that we need to change, some things we need to do better. We have a healthy identity, a healthy body, a healthy family of believers, and so we're excited about that. It gives us tools to work with. You know, one of the things that we observe about our church, and I exemplify this, all right? We're a church of highly educated, in many cases, highly proficient, capable professionals, along with the personality that comes with that. That's my polite way of saying we're engineers, we're mathematicians, we're scientists, we're businessmen and women, we're educators, we're medical professionals, we like reading books, we like following the news, we like having, you know, opinions and conversations. What that means for us as a church is we love having Bible studies. We love having Bible studies, and so we have Bible study. We have, you know, teaching kind of sermons on Sunday, and we have Bible studies on Sunday morning or Sunday night and on Tuesdays sometimes and Wednesdays more, and then we might go to another Bible study on Thursday. We love reading. We love learning because it enriches us, and that may not be everybody, but I think you guys recognize as a church that's part of who we are. Our gifts are much more in line with scholarship and knowledge and theology and apologetics, understanding these kinds of things. And so that is important and that is good, but what it can mean is that we are not always naturally bent towards evangelism. It's harder for us. Yeah? It is. Maybe not for everybody. There are people in the room that are gifted, and we see it in you, gifted at this. But we have to identify moving forward that God has called us to arise and go and tell. That's a key entity of what our mission is. And so what does that look like for a church whose identity is ours? What does that look like? And those are questions that we're going to be asking. And I hope as we're asking them corporately, you're asking them yourself. How do you just engage people in conversations about spiritual things, about what God is doing in your life, about what's going on at your church, about, you know, in positive ways? We do not want to be the kinds of people who profess worshiping God and yet disobey him out of both sides of the same mouth. And so, Jonah says, they knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord. Moving on, verse 11. So the sailors say to him, "What should we do to you that the sea may be calm for us?" For the sea was becoming increasingly stormy. And so Jonah says, and you remember verse 12. We'll come back to this verse when we get to chapter 4. Jonah says, "Pick me up and throw me into the sea. Then the sea will become calm for you. For I know that on account of me, this great storm has come upon you." Was this Jonah's only option? I'm not going to give you an answer to that today. I just want you to think about this was an option, but was this Jonah's only option? And if it's not his only option, why did he pick this one? What does that say about him? I'd rather drown out here than go do what God called me to do. That's my interpretation. You read as you will. Pick me up and throw me overboard. However, the men rowed desperately to return to land. In other words, they heard what Jonah said and they said, "No." And they pick up their oars and they try to get back to land. But they could not, for the sea was becoming even stormier against them. And then they called on Yahweh and said, "We earnestly pray, O Yahweh, do not let us perish on account of this man's life, and do not put innocent blood on us, for you, O Yahweh, have done as you have pleased." Did Jonah have another option? Maybe the sailors just exemplified one. These men who had heard of him but didn't worship Yahweh, didn't claim to believe in him, all of a sudden start praying in his name. So they picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea stopped its raging. And then the men feared not the sea, not the storm. They feared Yahweh greatly, and they offered a sacrifice to Yahweh and made vows to him. It is not just the Ninevites that are going to make Jonah look foolish. These pagan sailors do a perfect job if you read it carefully. If you read it carefully, real quick, third point this morning. The pagan sailors had the capacity to recognize the power of God when they saw it and turn to him in worship. Jonah pouted and slept and casually agreed to die instead of going to Nineveh. Meanwhile, these pagan sailors did everything in their power to save Jonah. Look, if I'm on the ship and we're about to go down, and this guy tells me it's his fault, I'm going to take up an oar too, and I'm going to take it to Jonah, the back of Jonah's head, as I'm knocking him off the boat. I'm not taking up an oar and putting it in the water and trying to swim back to land. The sailors did everything they could to save Jonah, only reluctantly throwing him overboard. And when the sea died down, they offered sacrifices to Jonah's God. So awesome. So convicting. Oh, man, really? Next slide. The narrative. This narrative is a reminder to us that even those farthest from God have the capacity to recognize God's power when they see it. They have the capacity to recognize God's power when confronted with it. And they have the ability to repent, no matter how far from God they happen to be. They have the ability to repent and to worship Him. The question is, are we going to be willing to get up out of our comfortable environment and put ourselves in a pathway where we will... This was on accident. What's going to happen when Jonah actually goes where God tells him to go? Oh, the exact same thing, by the way. It's be this story part two. But somebody has to be willing to get up and go, and then in the context of going, exemplify, speak, and live the power of God in front of people far from God. And so the questions that remain in front of us are these. Thoughts to consider. Arise, go, and call. It's the mantra this week. Man, I hope you guys will take those imperatives with you. Arise, go, and call. Do you recognize in the New Testament how these are commands given to all of us? They're given to all of us. And secondly, how can people far from God see the power of God on display in you individually and in us collectively as a church, whenever we bind together to serve Him with all of our hearts and all of our minds and all of our strength? How can people far from God see the power of God in you? And how can they see the power of God in us? I think they can. I'm proud to say at this church that they can. But we have to take it to them. They're not always coming here.